1990, with the continued help of the United States and, yes, also the dastardly French. With the approval of successive American governments, he spread his fingers through the crises of his neighboring African countries. Brazil. Left-leaning, democratically elected President Juan Goulart wasn't what Washington had in mind for South America's largest country. Despite pledging his solidarity to the United States during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Goulart's days were numbered. Preferring friendly authoritarian rule to democracy, the United States pushed a coup on Brazil, which resulted in 15 years of terror, torture, and killing. Indonesia. The Southeast Asian archipelago state is one of America's favorite allies and also happens to be home to yet another repressive regime. It is also the world's most populous Muslim country. In 1965, yet another democratically elected president was overthrown with the help of the United States government, which installed in his place yet another military dictatorship. General Suharto headed a hard-line government that ruled the country for 3 decades. Around 500,000 people were killed in the years after Suharto took power. But that didn't stop the U.S. from approving in advance Indonesia's illegal annexation of East Timor in the 70s. About 200,000 more people died there. Of course, there are many, many more examples, from dictators we supported to democratically elected governments we simply threw into chaos or got rid of altogether. Guatemala and Iran in the 50s and Chile in the 70s are further examples of how much we love freedom by helping to overthrow heads of state who were chosen by their own citizens. These days, China, the world's biggest Saddamorama, is our favorite dictatorship. The government imposes severe limits on media outlets, the internet, workers' rights, religious freedom, and any attempts at independent thinking. Combined with a judicial system that totally ignores any rule of law and is festering with corruption, China is a perfect place for American companies to do business. There are more than 800 Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurants in China, around 400 McDonald's, and another 100 Pizza Huts. Kodak is quickly approaching a monopoly on film sales. The many companies who have set up shop there are not only hawking their wares to the Chinese. The $103 billion trade imbalance between China and the United States is the largest deficit between two countries the world has ever seen. We import 6 times as much as we export, with Walmart alone accounting for $12 billion worth of Chinese imports, making the all-Sino-American company one of China's biggest trading partners, ahead of Russia and Great Britain. There are plenty of other companies taking advantage of the state-controlled, cheap labor in China, too. From General Motors to Boeing to, hell, just take off your pants and have a look at the label. Or dismantle your television. Or take off your pants while you're dismantling your television. And while China makes a killing on exports, and American corporations make a killing on high profit returns, the American economy flounders, and the Chinese people, well, they just wait for the government's mobile killing vans to pull around the corner, grab them, and put them out of their misery. If the criteria for invading another country is liberating the people from an oppressive regime, well then, we better hurry up and institute mandatory military service for every man and woman 18 and older because, by God, we're going to be busy. Since we've already invaded Iraq to free the Iraqis, we might as well continue with the other countries we've royally screwed. After that, maybe we can head back to Afghanistan, then on to Burma, Peru, Colombia, Sierra Leone, and end up somewhere that at least sounds nice, Cote d'Ivoire. Before the Iraq War, when the public was being duped with the endless barrage of whoppers, the idea of liberation of the Iraqi people was always tacked on as an afterthought. It never took a front and center position in the justifications for why we had to go to war right then. Why? Obviously, those who choose our wars don't care much about liberating people from oppressive regimes. If they did, we'd be kicking the shit out of half the world. No, they talk about our security, and even more important to them, our interests, And we all know that our interests have never included the good life for anyone but us. We don't share the wealth, be it monetary or ideological. We just cover our own asses and enhance our own well-being. It's plain to see, and it's everywhere, from welfare to work, to our exploitation of cheap labor, to our historical love of dictators, to our refusal to forgive third-world debt. Liberation sounds nice, but it ain't worth dying for, and it sure as hell isn't worth a dime of our money. Cheap gas, cheap clothes, cheap TVs? Yeah, that's more like it. Even professional warmonger and Bush advisor Paul Wolfowitz came clean with the truth in the Defense Department transcript of a May 2003 interview with Vanity Fair. The truth is that for reasons that have a lot to do with the U.S. government bureaucracy, we settled on the one issue that everyone could agree on, which was weapons of mass destruction as the core reason. There have always been three fundamental concerns. One is weapons of mass destruction. The second is support for terrorism. The third is the criminal treatment of the Iraqi people. Actually, I guess you could say there's a fourth overriding one, which is the connection between the first two. The third one by itself, as I think I said earlier, is a reason to help the Iraqis, but it's not a reason to put American kids' lives at risk. Certainly not on the scale we did it. Not worth the risk? Then why did we do it? Of course, Wolfowitz had deviated from the script. When no weapons of mass destruction were found, and not a single al-Qaeda guy showed up in the parts of Iraq under Saddam Hussein's control, and when that imminent threat Saddam posed to America's security couldn't be proven, the Bush administration and its many media puppets quickly tried to change their whopper order. No, you see, we weren't there to find nuclear weapons. We were there to free the people of Iraq. Yes, that's the reason we bombed the place and sent 150,000 troops to invade. You know how sometimes they give you the wrong whopper when they've switched yours with someone else's? You then have to decide whether you're just going to go ahead and eat this whopper or take it back and get the one you ordered. After the original justifications for war were exposed as lies, this new whopper gave pro-war Democrats and liberals a place to duck when they went looking for cover. How could they be so stupid as to believe Bush's claims regarding the weapons of mass destruction and the 9/11 connection? Hey, we weren't stupid. Look at all these mass graves we've uncovered. That's why we supported the war, to stop this brutality and oppression, the Democrats cried. That's right. Say it two more times, click your heels together, and tell yourself there's no place like home. There's no place like home. There's no place like home. That's what we have brought to the Iraqis, a little piece of home. The American way. Democracy. That's why we're there. That's what we'll give them. Recently on Nightline, they were interviewing an Iraqi woman who is pro-American and teaches English. She said that things are so bad now since the American invasion, she sometimes wishes Saddam were still in power. Her sentiment seems widespread. 20 years of living under a brutal dictator, and after only 90 days of living under the Americans, they want Saddam back. Geez, how bad a houseguest have we been? It seems that the crazy clerics are succeeding in filling the vacuum left by Saddam. And now it's meet the new boss, same as the old boss, time in Iraq. The Bush administration continually postpones turning control of the country over to the Iraqi people whom they've liberated. Why is that? Because they know that if elections were held today, the people would democratically vote to stop having democracy and to give the country over to some rabid fundamentalist. Already, women are living in fear for their lives if they don't cover up. And anyone who sells alcohol or shows movies is facing execution. Woohoo! Freedom! Democracy! Liberation! I can't wait to see who we're going to free next around the world. Number 5. Whopper with freedom fries and American cheese. The French are not on our side, and they may be our enemy. When you're into Tourette's lying, a number of things can happen. For instance, you're telling so many lies, you forget which lie you're telling, or which one you're supposed to be telling, or who you're supposed to be telling it to, Or if you've already told this person, or maybe you told it slightly differently before, and you're trying your damnedest to make sure the stories match, and then you have to get everybody who has joined you in the cereal line all on the same page, and before you know it, you're so jimmy jammed up and spinning yourself into such a mess that your only recourse, your only way out, is to blame someone else. Enter France. When you need a scapegoat, when you need a worthy whipping boy, you really can't do better than the country of France. And that's who the Bush pundits went after, accusing the French of being an axis of weasels. All of this was done to distract the American public from the real rats who were in Washington. France had decided not to support any rush to war in Iraq. It tried to convince the United States to let the weapons inspectors do their job. The French Minister of Foreign Affairs, Dominique de Villepin, spoke eloquently at the United Nations as the war began. Make no mistake about it, the choice is indeed between two visions of the world. To those who choose to use force and think they can resolve the world's complexity through swift and preventive action, we offer, in contrast, determined action over time. For today, to ensure our security, all the dimensions of the problem must be taken into account, both the manifold crises and their many facets, including cultural and religious. Nothing lasting in international relations can be built, therefore, without dialogue and respect for the other, without exigency and abiding by principles, especially for the democracies that must set the example. To ignore this is to run the risk of misunderstanding, radicalization, and spiraling violence. This is even more true in the Middle East, an area of fractures and ancient conflicts where stability must be a major objective for us. During the first Gulf War, the United States had the support of an actual coalition of powerful allies. But when it came to Gulf War, the sequel, most of those countries weren't so eager to sign up. Bush and his crack team of diplomats were left with a not-so-broad, not-so-daunting 49-member coalition of the willing. Most of these were countries, such as Tonga, Azerbaijan, and Palau, who always get picked last for United Nations volleyball games and will never get invited to the prom, not even by their desperate cousins. They're pathetically grateful to be asked for anything. See Whopper number 6. You'd think that if there was a serious threat of Saddam Hussein using his vast stockpile of weapons of mass destruction or invading another nation, more countries would have quickly jumped into the fray to stop the madman, especially those countries much closer to Iraq. The French, meanwhile, were taking it in the baguette. You don't disobey the United States and get away with it. And you certainly don't tell everyone we're lying, especially when we are. Bush, his policymakers, and their little mouthpieces got busy attacking the Frenchies. There was soft-spoken diplomat Colin Powell on PBS saying, "It was a very difficult period as we went through that second resolution vote, and we didn't believe that France was playing a helpful role." When Powell was asked if France would suffer for not supporting America's stance on war, the Secretary of State said simply, "Yes." Donald Rumsfeld took a different approach, a more insulting one. In responding to a question about Europe's view of the war, "You're thinking of Europe as Germany and France. I don't. I think that's old Europe." Rummy apparently prefers to think of Europe, or Nouveau Europe as he calls it, as containing only such vital coalition members as Albania, Estonia, Hungary, Latvia, and Slovakia. On the subject of French President Jacques Chirac, Bush told Tom Brokaw of NBC, "I doubt he'll be coming to the ranch anytime soon." Chirac was no doubt heartbroken at the prospect of missing a visit to Crawford, Texas. But it was an anonymous White House staffer who dealt the harshest punishment of all, accusing Democratic presidential hopeful and decorated Vietnam veteran Senator John Kerry of looking French. Representative Jim Saxton, Republican New Jersey, proposed legislation in the House to keep French companies from getting U.S. financing for the reconstruction of Iraq. His colleague, Representative Ginny Brown-Waite, Republican Florida, cooked up an even better way to really give the French that old what for. She introduced a bill to bring the bodies of World War II soldiers who had died and been buried in France back to the United States. "The remains of our brave heroes should be buried in patriotic soil," she explained, "not in a country that has turned its back on us." An anti-tax group ran ads against two Republican U.S. senators who opposed Bush's tax cut. The ads pictured each senator standing next to a waving French flag with the message, "President Bush courageously led the forces of freedom, but some so-called allies like France stood in the way. At home, President Bush has proposed bold job-creating tax cuts to boost the economy. But some so-called Republicans stand in the way." Fox News commentator Sean Hannity told his viewers, "If I had a trip planned to France this summer, I would have canceled it. I'm going to tell you why. What Jacques Chirac did in our moment of need and how he undermined us, and to the extent that he did it for his own selfish reasons, his duplicity is beyond forgiveness at this point. I'm sorry, I would tell every American to stay away from France. Go to Great Britain." It wasn't long after being fed these French whoppers that the American people took the bait. French wine was poured onto the street, and at one New Jersey restaurant, down the toilet. French restaurants were shunned. Vacationers canceled their plans to travel to France, with bookings down 30%. The Congressional Dining Room substituted freedom fries for French fries on its menu, following the lead of a North Carolina restaurant owner who was following the lead of a World War I era effort to rename sauerkraut Liberty Cabbage. Restaurants across the country followed suit, and as the president of Fuddruckers restaurant chain put it, "Every guest who steps up to a counter at their local Fuddruckers and says, 'Give me freedom fries,' shows their true support for those who guard our most important freedoms, especially freedom from fear, not to mention freedom from facts." What we know as French fries originated in Belgium. More than 200 years ago, Patrick Henry voiced the battle cry of the American Revolution with, "Give me liberty or give me death." Today he could demonstrate his patriotic zeal by changing his takeout order. A Lebanese-owned chain of stores in California's San Joaquin Valley, French Cleaners, had one of its stores tagged with anti-French graffiti and another burned to the ground. The French-owned Sofitel Hotel in Manhattan replaced the French flag flying outside with Old Glory. Fromage.com, a French cheese distributor, received hundreds of hostile emails. In Las Vegas, an armored fighting vehicle, complete with two machine guns and a 76-millimeter cannon, was used to crush French yogurt, French bread, bottles of French wine, Perrier, Grey Goose vodka, photos of Chirac, a guide to Paris, and, best of all, photocopies of the French flag. The makers of British-owned French's Mustard didn't wait for a backlash. They put out a press release explaining that the only thing French about French's Mustard is the name. Throughout the U.S., programs that matched visiting French students with American families were unable to find enough U.S. hosts for the first time in years. One weasel who escaped this wrath was the White House pastry chef, a man who, despite his Frenchness, was entrusted with preparing our president's meals. Mocking your longtime allies by renaming food and wasting a lot of expensive wine is all fine and good, but George W. Bush still needs his pain au chocolat. It gives him fortitude, or freedom strength. Of course, it was easy to go after France. Too many of its citizens had been rude to us, and it had this history of always seeming to cave to despots. While it had brave resistance fighters and many French citizens died during World War II, instead of fighting the Germans to the bitter end, like the Russians did, France decided to cooperate and collaborate, especially when it came to rounding up the Jews and commies and sending them off to die in concentration camps. Plus, the French had a history of not getting things quite right. like the Maginot Line, a series of bunkers built along the French-German border before World War II to defend France from the invading Huns. The only problem was they built the bunkers facing the wrong way, and the Germans were deep into France before you could say, "Garçon, more stinky cheese, please." Then there's the simple jealousy factor. Most Americans know the French are more sophisticated, more intelligent, more well-read than the average American. We don't like to admit that it was the French who invented the movies, the automobile, the stethoscope, Braille, photography, and most important of all, the Etch-a-Sketch. They've brought us the Enlightenment, and the Enlightenment paved the way for the widespread acceptance of all the ideas and principles that America was founded on. Then, when we find out that the French have to work only 35 hours a week and everyone gets at least 4 weeks paid vacation, all we can do is make snide remarks about their unions and how they're always shutting their country down. So France was the perfect country to pick on, and it was an entertaining distraction. If you're a cable news company, why spend priceless reporting time on investigating whether Iraq really does have weapons of mass destruction when you can do a story about how rotten the French are? Yet, after the lies started to unravel, a few people started to reconsider what they had been told about the French and what they really did to us. It turns out it was more like what the French have done for us. Most Americans can barely remember who won last year's Super Bowl, let alone the true story of how this country was founded. We all know about the Tea Party and Paul Revere's Midnight Ride, but we like to forget that we never could have won the war without the French. Hell, we don't even want to think about the fact that Revere's father was French, and it wasn't Revere, it was Revoir. But it was the French and the British War over Canada that really pushed the colonists over the edge. They were left to pay taxes on stamps and on tea to the crown to help the crown pay for a war the colonies had not gotten themselves into. When the colonial anger and frustration peaked and the colonies decided to break away, they knew perfectly well that they could not do it alone. They turned to the French, and the French gleefully agreed to aid in the humiliation of the British. They sent troops, ships, 90% of the gunpowder we used, and tens of millions of dollars. The war ended at Yorktown, with the British surrendering to Washington, and the band playing "The World Turned Upside Down," but the Brits were actually surrendering to the French. The redcoats were boxed in by the French Navy, and on that final day, there were more French troops in the ranks than colonists. In fact, France has always been the best friend to the United States. Almost a third of France's direct foreign investment is in the United States. They are our fifth largest investor, and the French employ 650,000 people in the United States. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights was written by a committee chaired by Eleanor Roosevelt, with René Cassin of France as the vice chair. And, much like in Vietnam, we share a joint sordid history in Iraq, where the Iraqi Petroleum Company, owned by U.S., British, Dutch, and French oil giants, exploited Iraq's oil. Still, Americans accused the French of all kinds of treachery when it came to Iraq. There were claims that the French were only opposing war to get economic benefits out of Saddam Hussein's Iraq. In fact, it was the Americans who were making a killing. In 2001, the U.S. was Iraq's leading trading partner, consuming more than 40% of Iraq's oil exports. That's $6 billion in trade with the Iraqi dictator. By contrast, 8% of Iraq's oil exports went to France in 2001. Fox News led the charge of pinning Chirac to Saddam Hussein, showing old footage of the two men together. It didn't matter that the meeting had taken place in the 1970s. The media didn't bother to run over and over again the footage from when Saddam was presented with a key to the city of Detroit, or the film in the early 1980s when Donald Rumsfeld went to visit Saddam in Baghdad to discuss the progress of the Iran-Iraq war. Those videos of Rumsfeld embracing Saddam apparently weren't worth running on a continuous loop. Or even once. Okay, maybe once. On Oprah. And when she showed Rumsfeld all lovey with Saddam, there was an audible gasp in her studio audience. Every day, average Americans were shocked to see that the devil was actually our devil. Thank you, Oprah. How soon we forgot that it was the French who led the United Nations Security Council on the day after September 11 to condemn the attacks and demand justice for the victims. Jacques Chirac was the first foreign leader to travel to America after the attacks to offer his support and condolences. One of the signs of true friendship is when your friend feels comfortable enough to let you know when you're screwing up. That is the kind of friend you should hope for. That is the kind of friend France was being, until we took a piss on our best friend, biting into the Whopper while freedom fried. Number 6. Whopper Combo Extra Lettuce. This is not just the United States going to Iraq. It is a coalition of the willing. This is my favorite Whopper because I can't stop laughing whenever I think about it. In order to put some sort of international feel-good happy face on our invasion of Iraq, Bush stated that, hey, it's not just we who feel this way about Saddam. Many nations, however, do have the resolve and fortitude to act against the threat to peace, and a broad coalition is now gathering to enforce the just demands of the world. The United Nations Security Council has not lived up to its responsibilities, so we will rise to ours. Of course, it's always better sharing your Whopper with friends, and the more the better. That way, everyone shares in the sacrifice equally. No one country will have to see only its young boys and girls die. No one country's citizens will have to bear the entire burden of billions of dollars to fight the war and then rebuild the country. No one country wants to see its cities and states go bankrupt and run up billions of dollars in debt just to remove one lousy dictator. So, let's create a coalition to share the load. What a lovely idea. Only one problem. Hardly anybody wanted to join this coalition of the willing. So just who were the motley crew of oddball nations that signed on to Bush's madness? Let's take a look at the list. It begins with Afghanistan. Okay, stop right there. Afghanistan? What exactly was their contribution going to be? Horses? 10 sticks and a stone? Don't they have their own problems at the moment? Or did they have a warlord or two to spare to help us out in Iraq? I have asked the State Department to provide me with a list of the contributions that the nation of Afghanistan made to the war effort, and so far, no one has responded. Batting next for the Coalition of the Willing is another heavy hitter, Albania. Is this the same Albania where the main industry is survival farming, where there's one phone for every 30 people? Let's keep going. Australia. Now that's a real country. Except the polls in Australia leading up to the war showed that its citizens, by a margin of 70%, opposed the war. So how did they get on the list? George W. Bush dangled the prospect of a free trade agreement in front of Australian Prime Minister John Howard. If you can't join them, or they won't join you, bribe them. Meanwhile, Aussie neighbor New Zealand, who refused to join the coalition, was then, surprise, shut out of trade talks. Back to the willing. Azerbaijan. We're coming to get their oil next, so they had no friggin' choice. Bulgaria. Anytime you've got Bulgaria on your side, how can you lose? Plus, I got to write Bulgaria twice in the same book. Colombia, taking a break from that other war we're fighting there. The Czech Republic. How embarrassing. We were going to let you into NATO anyway. Denmark. This alone should disqualify them from membership in Scandinavia. I never thought they belonged in it anyway. Let Finland in, where it belongs. El Salvador. We didn't annex them for nothing. Eritrea. Where the hell is that? Estonia. See, France, some Nazi collaborators love us. Ethiopia. Nothing like sending a squad of starving children to help. Georgia. Hungary, Italy, that's the second real country, with 69% opposed to the war. Japan, no way, I don't believe this. Do the Japanese people, 70% of whom oppose the war, know they got put on this list? South Korea, Latvia, more Nazi collaborators. Lithuania, even more collaborators. Macedonia, the Netherlands, huh? Too much legalized drug use? Nicaragua, the Philippines. Maybe they should be spending their time routing out their own members of Al-Qaeda. Poland. Didn't they hear that the Pope said the war was wrong? Palau. Palau? Palau is a group of North Pacific islands with 20,000 citizens, barely enough to fill Madison Square Garden. They do have, as the Washington Post pointed out, yummy tapioca and succulent coconuts, but unfortunately, no troops. Of course, not having an army is no impediment to being in the coalition of the willing. Other armyless members include Iceland, Costa Rica, the Marshall Islands, the Solomon Islands, and Micronesia. But hey, we don't expect them to send their kids off to die. That's our job. We just want them to be willing to do it. Wait, newsflash, Poland did offer to send 200 troops. Thank you for your willingness. And while Morocco also was short on military assistance, they did offer to send 2,000 monkeys to help detonate landmines in Iraq. But they didn't, and if you don't cough up the monkeys, you don't get to reap the benefits of being a member of the Coalition of the Willing. Anyways, the Coalition of the Willing doesn't need monkeys when it's already got a more advanced simian leading it. But I'm getting out of order here. Let's see, that leaves Romania, Slovakia, Spain. Only 13% of Spaniards were in favor of war, and that was only if it was a UN-supported invasion. And, hold the phone, Turkey. Turkish politicians refused $26 billion for the privilege of having U.S. troops based there. Maybe they were paying attention to the polls that showed 95% of Turks opposed invading Iraq. Bringing up the rear is the United Kingdom, our bestest friend in the whole wide world, and Uzbekistan. In the United Kingdom, only 9% supported military action against Iraq if it meant the U.S. and the U.K. going it alone. The Brits were split evenly on who the greatest threat to world peace was, with Bush and Hussein each getting 45% of the vote. Why would Tony Blair involve himself in this? What did Bush promise him? So there we have the Coalition of the Willing, representing about 20% of the world's population. But even that is deceptive, since most of the coalition members' citizens oppose the war in Iraq, making them the Coalition of the Coerced, or more accurately, the Coalition of the Coerced, Bribed, and Intimidated. For the record, here are a few of the many countries that wanted nothing to do with this fiasco, the Coalition of the Unwilling: Algeria, Argentina, Austria, Belgium, Brazil, Canada, Chile, China, Cuba, Egypt, Finland, France, Germany, Greece, India, Indonesia, Iran, Ireland, Israel, Jordan, Mexico, New Zealand, Nigeria, Norway, Pakistan, Russia, South Africa, Sweden, Switzerland, Syria, Thailand, United Arab Emirates, Venezuela, Vietnam, Yemen, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and 103 other countries. Hey, who needs them? Chickens, losers, weasels. Number 7. Junior Whopper Kids Meal. We are doing everything possible so that no civilian lives are lost. We learned a lot in the 1990s about how to fight a war and keep the Yank losses to the absolute minimum. That's what you get with a liberal in the White House. Clinton closed bases, reduced the number of troops, and funneled money into figuring out ways to bomb people from far away. No fuss, no muss. By the time Bill was finished, we had one lean, mean, high-tech fighting machine. One of my favorite Clinton defense projects was the one located in Littleton, Colorado, up the road from Columbine High School. There, Lockheed Martin, the biggest arms maker in the world, built rockets that carried into space the special new satellites that guided the missiles fired into Baghdad. When Bush unleashed a firestorm on Iraq's capital city, with a civilian population of 5 million during Gulf War II, it couldn't have happened without those Lockheed rocket carriers. This precision-guided bombing began a whole new era of warfare. It was accurate almost to the inch, and it could be coordinated from the Army's Central Command in Tampa, Florida. The same satellites were used to bomb Afghanistan after September 11. And between these two bombing campaigns, according to some estimates, 9,000 civilians were murdered. Three times as many civilians as died on September 11, and 8,985 more than died at Columbine High School. The Pentagon brags about how perfect their guidance systems are now, and that in targeting only military installations, no civilians need die. Tell that to the family of Rezek Al-Kazim Al-Khafaji, who lost his wife, 6 children, his father, his mother, and 2 brothers in one attack. "God take our revenge on America," he wailed to reporters amid the rubble and body parts. Wow, what an ingrate. Then there was the boy who lost his parents and his 2 arms when a U.S. missile struck his home. As tears streamed down his cheek, he begged reporters to help him find his arms. Or the mother who began sobbing uncontrollably, then fainted as she watched as a young woman's torso, then a severed head, her daughter's, were pulled from a smoldering crater. The crater had been made by 4 U.S. bombs aimed at a restaurant that Saddam Hussein might have been in. Instead, the bombs obliterated 3 homes, killing 14 people, including 7 children and the woman's daughter. You would think that Iraqis would be grateful to have their family members dismembered so that Americans might be safe from Saddam and his elusive weapons of mass destruction, and not carry on all fainty and teary like that. One thing was clear, though. For the second time since September 11, American officials were scratching their heads and wondering how another prime evildoer had gotten away. While these same U.S. officials were killing Iraqi civilians, they left the counting to others. A British-American research group in London announced estimates of civilian deaths due to the war at between 6,806 and 7,797. That's a lot of accidents when you are talking about precision-guided weapons. Of course, the Pentagon doesn't like to talk about the search-and-destroy missions or the cluster bombs. Each 1,000-pound cluster bomb delivers 200 to 300 bomblets, which in turn can spread hundreds of fragments over an area equivalent to several football fields. The bomblets, which can look like little toys to children, by the Pentagon's own estimates, fail to explode upon impact 5 to 20% of the time, and so they sit on the ground until some unsuspecting child picks one up. Of course, just because the bleeding hearts at Human Rights Watch say that it's an outrage to use cluster bombs in urban areas where they remain dangerous for years doesn't mean we don't care about civilian casualties. No, we will make sure that our media doesn't disrespect the poor Iraqis by showing us disgusting images of maimed children at dinner time. We promise only to show the bullet-ridden bodies of Saddam's sons, Uday and Qusay. Once, twice, 100 times, that's all. Because so many of our soldiers have been shot since Bush declared the war over, the soldiers have been understandably jumpy. Every civilian looks like a potential killer. Thus, innocent Iraqis have been shot by our soldiers, like the 10 women and children killed by U.S. soldiers when their van failed to stop at a checkpoint. They apparently thought they were heeding a U.S. order to evacuate toward the checkpoint. "Sorry about that," said General Richard Myers. This kind of environment is never going to get better, not as long as we are the occupiers and they are the ones wondering where the electricity is. Number 8 Whopper, Hold the Mayo. We are there to protect the oil fields of Iraq. This one's true. Number 9. Double Whopper with Cheese and a Coke. The American media has brought you the truth about Iraq. If you're going to sell a mess of Whoppers, you need a good advertising campaign. Corporations pay big money for that kind of marketing, but the Bush administration didn't have to spend a dime when the supposedly liberal media joined forces with the White House field office at Fox News to create a well-oiled pro-war propaganda offensive that was almost impossible to avoid. And it worked. Even vegetarians were gobbling down these Whoppers. Accompanied by round-the-clock patriotic march-to-war music and flag-inspired graphics on the sorry excuses for news channels, the images were relentless. Tearful farewells from proud families as brave soldiers headed overseas. Heroic American girls rescued by daring American guys. Smart bombs doing their brilliantly destructive work. Grateful Iraqis toppling the Saddam statue. A united America standing by our resolute and determined leader. Then there was the footage beamed directly to us from the harsh Iraqi desert, where reporters, embedded with the ground troops, were given great leeway to report without interference from the Pentagon, as we were supposed to believe. The result? Lots of up-close and personal stories about the hardships and dangers faced by our military, and virtually nothing examining why we had sent these fine young people into harm's way. And there was even less said about what was happening to the people of Iraq. So unless you ignored U.S. news entirely and only watched the BBC or CBC or Le Journal from France with its convenient English subtitles for an American audience too lazy and poorly educated to have learned another language, you could pretty quickly find yourself believing that all the sacrifice was for a valid cause. And just what exactly was the reason for the war with Iraq? We were so thoroughly whopperized that polls showed that half of all Americans wrongly thought that Iraqis were on the September 11 planes, and at one point, nearly half believed that the U.S. had found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, when no such discovery had been made. One quarter of those surveyed thought that Saddam had unleashed a chemical or biological attack against coalition forces, which also hadn't happened. The widespread misconceptions were understandable. It was almost impossible to hear the perspective of anyone who questioned or opposed the Bush administration's rationale for rushing to war on American television. The media watchdog group, FAIR, studied the evening newscasts of 6 U.S. television networks and news channels for 3 weeks, starting on March 20, 2003, the day after the U.S. bombing of Iraq began. The study examined the affiliations and views of more than 1,600 sources who appeared on camera in stories about Iraq. The results were hardly a surprise. Viewers were 25 times more likely to see a pro-war U.S. source than someone with an anti-war point of view. Military sources were featured twice as frequently as civilians. Only 4% of sources appearing during the 3 weeks were affiliated with universities, think tanks, or non-governmental organizations. Of a total of 840 U.S. sources who were current or former government or military officials, only 4 were identified as opposing the war. The few appearances by people with anti-war viewpoints were consistently limited to one-sentence soundbites, usually from unidentified participants in on-the-street interviews. Not a single one of the 6 telecasts studied conducted a sit-down interview with anyone who opposed the war. In some cases, journalists freely confessed to a startling lack of objectivity. The FAIR study quoted CBS News anchor Dan Rather during an appearance with Larry King on CNN. "Look, I'm an American. I never tried to kid anybody that I'm some internationalist or something. And when my country is at war, I want my country to win, whatever the definition of win may be. Now, I can't and I don't argue that that is coverage without a prejudice, About that, I am prejudiced. During the 3-week study period, Thayer found only one anti-war soundbite on Rather's CBS Evening News. It was made by, me at the Academy Awards, talking about the fictitious war waged by our fictitious president. Over at Fox News, Neil Cavuto had this to say on air in response to a critic. "There is nothing wrong with taking sides here. You see no difference between a government that oppresses people and one that does not, but I do." MSNBC demonstrated its patriotism with America's Bravest, a billboard of photographs of military personnel fighting in the war, sent for display by their friends and families. And Brian Williams of NBC and MSNBC said this about the killing of Iraqi civilians. "Civilians used to be intentional military targets. The firebombings of Dresden and Tokyo in World War II were meant to kill civilians and then terrorize survivors. Here we've seen the opposite happen." The Army recently signed a $470 million contract with Microsoft, which is co-owner of MSNBC along with NBC. NBC is in turn owned by General Electric, one of the nation's largest defense contractors. GE's military aircraft engine contracts run in the billions, but the Thayer study found that NBC actually featured more dissenting viewpoints about the war, a whopping 1% more, than any of the other U.S. networks. Here are just a few more of the mini whoppers provided by American networks and newspapers about the war in Iraq. ABC reported on April 26, 2003, that the U.S. military has found a weapons site 130 miles northwest of Baghdad that has initially tested positive for chemical agents. Among the materials there, 14 55-gallon drums, at least a dozen missiles, and 150 gas masks. Turns out there were no chemical weapons at the site, and the earlier reports were completely wrong. ABC did not run a correction or a retraction. The New York Times helped get the weapons of mass destruction ball rolling with this story on September 8, 2002, headlined, "U.S. Says Hussein Intensifies Quest for A-Bomb Parts." More than a decade after Saddam Hussein agreed to give up weapons of mass destruction, Iraq has stepped up its quest for nuclear weapons and has embarked on a worldwide hunt for materials to make an atomic bomb, Bush administration officials said today. In the last 14 months, Iraq has sought to buy thousands of specially designed aluminum tubes, which American officials believe were intended as components of centrifuges to enrich uranium. The story? Wrong. The Washington Post brought us the riveting story of PFC, Private First Class, Jessica Lynch, the young soldier who was rescued from an Iraqi hospital after being seriously injured during a battle in the Iraqi desert. PFC Jessica Lynch, rescued Tuesday from an Iraqi hospital, fought fiercely and shot several enemy soldiers. Lynch, a 19-year-old supply clerk, continued firing at the Iraqis even after she sustained multiple gunshot wounds and watched several other soldiers in her unit die around her in fighting March 23, one official said. "She was fighting to the death," the official said. "She did not want to be taken alive." The New York Times provided more dramatic details of the heroic rescue. Navy Special Operations Forces, called SEALs, extracted Private Lynch while being fired upon going in and coming back out. Lynch was the first U.S. prisoner of war extracted from enemy hands since World War II, and it was the first time a woman has ever been rescued. It took some time, but the story soon became more complicated, as the New York Times reported 2 months later. It seems the plucky young private may not have fought like Rambo when her supply unit took a wrong turn into an Iraqi ambush. She may not have been shot and stabbed in that firefight, which may or may not have happened, and it seems likely now that she was not mistreated at an Iraqi hospital. Her heroic rescuers did not fight their way up the hospital halls. Indeed, the hospital staff may have been eager to hand her over. Lynch was in fact given special medical care by the Iraqi hospital staff for her wounds, none of which was battle-related. An Iraqi nurse sang her to sleep at night, and she was given extra juice and cookies. The hospital staff had already tried to turn her over to U.S. authorities and were, in fact, waiting for them to arrive. Iraqi forces had already vacated the area. While Lynch recovered in a U.S. hospital, television networks were tripping over themselves to get her exclusive story. CBS even offered her a package deal with book, concert, and TV movie prospects through CBS News, CBS Entertainment, MTV, and Simon & Schuster, all under the corporate umbrella of the huge Viacom Corporation. No matter where the Jessica Lynch tale ends up being told, it's sure to be more Survivor than The Real World. I feel sorry for her. A young woman who volunteered to risk her life to defend the United States, and she ends up being used like this, sandwiched in a mess hall full of Whoppers. Number 10. Triple Whopper Biggie Size. We didn't lie, and we're not lying now to cover up the lies we told you before. After a few in the media started to do their job and expose the lies of the Bush administration, after Bush struggled to find someone, anyone, to blame all the lying on, and after a majority of the American public said that they believed they were not told the whole truth about Iraq, Bush and company figured they had better come forward and put an end to this crisis once and for all. So this is what they did. They biggie-sized the Whoppers. This strategy is called the pile-on effect. If you are caught in a lie, just keep denying it and keep lying no matter what. Richard Pryor outlined this approach in his 1982 stand-up routine, Live on the Sunset Strip. Pryor suggested that when a man is caught by his wife in bed with another woman, he should deny everything, even though his wife is standing right there witnessing him naked and in bed with the other woman. Just deny that you were in the middle of having sex, said Pryor. Deny that there is even a woman in your bed. Now are you going to believe me or your lying eyes? One of the first Whoppers about the Whopper Squared, came last February when Colin Powell proclaimed, "My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we are giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence." Just days earlier, Powell apparently was not so sure. During a gathering of CIA officials reviewing the evidence against Saddam Hussein, Powell tossed the papers in the air and declared, "I'm not reading this. This is bullshit." And he had good reason to distrust the intelligence. A large chunk of Powell's background information had been lifted directly from sources easily located on the internet, including a graduate student's paper based on 12-year-old documents. Some sections had been outright plagiarized, to the extent that typos hadn't even been fixed, but Powell called all these Whoppers solid. Then White House spokesman Ari Fleischer gave it his spin. The president's statement was based on the predicate of the yellowcake, uranium, from Niger. So, given the fact that the report on the yellowcake did not turn out to be accurate, that is reflective of the president's broader statement. Huh? We'll leave the explaining to the Whopper Master himself, George W. Bush. I think the intelligence I get is darn good intelligence, and the speeches I have given were backed by good intelligence. I am absolutely convinced today, like I was convinced when I gave the speeches, that Saddam Hussein developed a program of weapons of mass destruction. Added Ari Fleischer, the president has moved on, and I think, frankly, much of the country has moved on as well. Maybe in his country, but not in mine. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld quickly dished up some more Whoppers on Meet the Press. It turns out that it's technically correct what the president said, but in the aggregate, do we believe that they had chemical and biological weapons and a nuclear program in progress? The answer is yes, I believe that. Rumsfeld added, "And right before it, I said, as the president said, and right after it, I said, as the president said. I was simply repeating what the president had said." Are you following this? Before your head spins completely off your neck, let's turn to Condoleezza Rice to clear it all up for us. She had this to say to CNN's Wolf Blitzer. Wolf, let me just start by saying it is 16 words, and it has become an enormously overblown issue. Now, I think now that we're in Iraq, and we are interviewing scientists, and we are looking at the documents, and we are finding, for instance, that he had somebody bury centrifuge parts in their yard. That whopper had spoiled so badly that it got Blitzer's attention, and Rice was forced to admit that her evidence was 12 years old. Before the first Gulf War, well, in 1991. Undeterred, Rice also appeared that day on Face the Nation, where she insisted that the President's State of the Union said something that was accurate. We use a lot of data points. We give them to writers. They go to speeches. And then we rely on a clearance process. And if you notice, the President's statement says, in Africa. It's not specific. It says he sought. It didn't say he received or he acquired. It's that he sought. And it cites the British document. It just doesn't stop. Whoppers on top of whoppers. So many whoppers, it could make a person sick. So many whoppers that even a witness to world-class lying, former Nixon aide John Dean, was moved to comment, it's important to recall that when Richard Nixon resigned, he was about to be impeached by the House of Representatives for misusing the CIA and FBI. Why are there no consequences for telling all these whoppers? Why is George W. Bush still occupying our White House? Where are the articles of impeachment? How many more whoppers will it take before Congress is full? Chapter 3. Oil's Well That Ends Well. Last night I had a dream. Actually, I had a number of dreams. One had something to do with smearing tofutti on a camel. Another involved me pushing around golfing great Fred Couples as he sat in my shopping cart while he recited sections of the Bhagavad Gita inside a Target store in Modesto, California. I know, I need help. It was one of those nights when you have been out partying too hard, and it's like once your head hits the pillow, some sort of high-speed mega-channel DirecTV comes on in your subconscious, and you can't find the remote to turn it off. I had been out celebrating the killings of Uday and Qusay Hussein with friends and loved ones. You can never discount the importance of getting together with those close to you when your government is able to corner and gun down people we don't like. But one too many shots of tequila, with the whole bar chanting, Uday, 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 as I chugged them down, was a bit too much, even for me. I hadn't partied this hard since the state of Texas executed that retard guy. Anyway, back to my main dream. It was so real, it felt like something right out of Scrooge. Suddenly, I was in the future. It was the year 2054, and it was the occasion of my 100th birthday. Either I had joined a health food co-op some years earlier, or, for some reason, the world ran out of Ben & Jerry's because I was looking pretty good for 100. In this dream, I received a surprise visit from my great-granddaughter, Ann Coulter Moore. I have no idea how she got that name, and I was too frightened to ask. She told me she was doing an oral history project for her 6th grade class at school, and she wanted to ask me a few questions. But there were no lights, she had no computer, and the water she was drinking was not in a bottle. Here is how the conversation went, as best as I can recall. Ann Coulter Moore. Hi, Great-Grandpa. I brought you a candle. For some reason, we got an extra one with our monthly ration. I figured there might not be enough light for the interview. Michael Moore. Thank you, Annie. Now, if there is any way you could leave me that pencil you're using when you're done, I could burn it to keep me warm. A. Sorry, Great-Grandpa, but if I give it to you, then I will have nothing to write with for the rest of the year. Back in your day, didn't you have other things to use when you wrote something? M. Yes, we had pens and computers, and we had little machines you could speak into, and out would come the writing. A. What happened to those? M. Well, dear, it takes plastic to make them. A. Oh, yes, plastic. Did everyone love plastic back then? M. It was a magical substance, but it was made from oil. A. I see. And ever since the oil dried up, we've had to use these pencils. M. That's right. Boy, we all miss the oil, don't we? A. When you were young, were people really so stupid to think that there was enough oil to last forever, or did they just not care about us? M. Of course we cared. But in my day, our leaders swore on a stack of Bibles there was plenty of oil, and of course, we wanted to believe them because we were having so much fun. A. So, when you started to run out of oil and you knew the end was near, what did you do? M. We tried to keep things under control by dominating those parts of the world where most of the remaining oil and natural gas was located. Many wars were fought. For the early wars in Kuwait and Iraq, our leaders had to come up with excuses like, this bad guy had bad weapons, or these good people needed to be liberated. We like that word, liberated. But the fighting was never really for any of those reasons. It was always about the oil. We just couldn't speak plainly in those days. The early wars didn't cost us a lot of lives, so it seemed everything would remain normal. But those wars only gave us a few more years of oil. A.